From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump is expected to face questions about how he'll temporarily suspend immigration into the U.S. by executive order. And in Congress, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is predicting that the Senate will soon pass additional money for small business coronavirus relief. Here he is on CNN.
Staff was up all night writing. There are still a few more I's to dot and T's to cross, but we have a deal.
Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. And Tam, what do we know about what's in this deal and what isn't in this deal? The sticking point had been extra money for states, which Democrats wanted.
Right. So this is sort of a booster shot, if you will, to follow up on the CARES Act that passed last month. It includes additional money for the Paycheck Protection Program. That's the program to give money to small businesses, loans that are basically forgivable, a very popular program that ran out of money very quickly. So the idea is to give it more money so that more small businesses can actually get the money. There's also some money in there for healthcare providers and additional funds for testing. As you say, what's not in there is funding for states. States have said that there are major budget shortfalls as a result of the economic consequences and the extra spending related to the coronavirus. They had asked for $500 billion in funding. That's not in there. Democrats wanted that. And ultimately, the administration and Republicans said, no, not this time. But President Trump has tweeted he's urging passage of this new bill. And he's saying that as soon as he signs it, there will be discussions that will begin on the next phase that would include money for state and local governments for lost revenues from COVID-19. He also wants infrastructure investments for bridge tunnels, broadband, and also money for restaurants, sports, and he wants a payroll tax cut. Some of that stuff is a wish list of his, certainly, but there's already bipartisan effort and push to get money for states and local governments.
And what can you tell us about the president's plans for an executive order temporarily suspending immigration? We should note, of course, that a lot of immigration has already been suspended because of the coronavirus, but he tweeted last night he wants to protect American jobs and prevent the spread of infection. What are the concerns about going as far as he wants to go now?
Well, what I can tell you is that that tweet came at 10 o'clock last night, and we don't have much more information now than we did when that tweet came out. The administration has not released language or details or been particularly forthcoming about who would be affected, which classes of immigrants or anything like that. You know, there are questions about guest workers, but the thought is that those wouldn't be affected. But we simply don't know. But as you say, an economic advisor to the White House, Kevin Hassett, was asked, well, what would the economic impact of this be? And he said, quote, there's so little travel right now that at the margin, the policy change that was announced last night isn't going to be economically significant in the short run because there's no one going anywhere. And the national security advisor said that this is purely temporary. And now we wait and see what the executive order actually says. The Trump campaign is already sending messages to the president's supporters, hyping this up.
Right. I mean, one concern that we've heard about is that migrant workers who come in for the agriculture sector won't be able to come in. So we'll continue to watch that and what President Trump does. Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's turn now to Iowa, where employees at several meatpacking plants are infected with the coronavirus. Today, the Tyson Foods pork plant in Columbus Junction is reopening for limited operations after being closed for 2 weeks. And in Waterloo, the Tyson Fresh Meats plant remains open despite calls for it to close after some workers there turned up sick. More than 250 people in the county surrounding Waterloo have also tested positive for the coronavirus. At least two people in the county have died. Amy Mayer is agricultural reporter for Iowa Public Radio. And Amy, can you describe the conditions of these plants and perhaps how it may be contributing to becoming a hotspot?
Sure. I have toured one of the plants, not one of the ones that you just mentioned, but another pork processing plant here in Iowa. These are very carefully laid out and orchestrated lines. There are lots of workers. Most of these plants operate at least two shifts a day. Some of them at times may operate around the clock. People are pretty close together, often described as shoulder to shoulder. The animals come in, they are slaughtered, they're drained, and then they're moved through these different stations where the workers have very specific jobs, so that the last stages of the plant are pieces of meat being wrapped and packaged and boxed up and shipped out the door to restaurants or stores or whatever their final destinations are.
Yeah, as I mentioned, one plant in Columbus Junction is reopening today. Have they said at all why they're reopening, and is it possible for them to do that safely?
When they closed, the agreement was they would close for 2 weeks. That would be time to do thorough disinfecting. It would mean 2 weeks from exposure for anyone who may have been asymptomatic to potentially demonstrate that they have stayed healthy. It was a timeline that I believe the company and the state government agreed to at the time of the shutdown. What they're doing as far as trying to keep employees healthy even before the shutdown, and partly what contributed to it, is that they were monitoring temperatures of everybody going into the plant. We've also been hearing about different companies trying to put some separation in on those tight working conditions, plexiglass dividers, providing face shields for workers, also staggering the times that people go into break rooms or locker rooms and trying to reduce the people passing each other. And of course, routine disinfecting of all surfaces, including even things like vending machine buttons.
Okay. Yeah, I mentioned the Waterloo plant as well. What has been the argument for keeping that plant open?
The argument for keeping any of the plants open, and it just has fallen on Waterloo right now because of the timing of the outbreaks in different plants, is that when you have the processors slowed or closed, you have a backup at the farm gate. And so you also have the potential for a slowdown in the meat getting out to retail establishments and consumers. But these short closures probably won't have a noticeable impact at the retail case in your supermarket. It's true that some people are seeing in certain grocery stores there isn't as much meat, but that probably has more to do with how much people are buying at one time and the time it takes for the stores to restock. We also, in this country, have hundreds of millions of pounds of meat in cold storage. So it's not so much that we could not have meat available as we might not be able to get specific cuts or the exact type of meat that we're most accustomed to.
That's Amy Mayer. She's an agricultural reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Thank you so much, Amy, for this update.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go now to a world-famous beach that remains closed to the public. Here's NPR's Philip Reeves in Rio de Janeiro.
Let's turn back the clock 5 weeks. It's Sunday at noon on Copacabana Beach. Everyone here knows the coronavirus is spreading in Brazil. This is their final day of sun worship before hibernation begins. The beach is a giant arc of golden sand, 2.5 miles long. Many thousands of people are here, stretched out under brightly coloured sunshades. Kids prance in the Atlantic surf. There's beach soccer. And in the cafes, minstrels. This place is so much more than a beach. It's a giant escape valve, a place to get away from the pressures of life in this tough tropical town. It's also a market in constant motion. There are thousands of vendors here, trudging around under a punishing sun, selling everything from grilled cheese and shrimp on sticks to string bikinis. Susana Portela has a stall selling coconuts and caipirinhas, Brazil's powerful cocktail made from sugarcane. The fact that the beach is about to close worries her a lot. I have no other work than this, she says. If I don't work, I don't know what I'll do. I have rent to pay. In the last few days, I've been thinking a lot about Susana and Copacabana and wondering why I go there so rarely. There's one event I try not to miss. Copacabana's New Year's Eve party, when people dress in white, toss flowers in the sea, and jump up and down 7 times in the surf, making wishes for good luck. How distant those celebrations seem now that we're staying inside. Or at least we're supposed to be. Recently, people have started returning to Rio's streets in defiance of the state governor, but egged on by Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, who's against broad social isolation. The other day, during my morning exercise, I cycled to Copacabana because I suspected the beach might be back in business. I was wrong.
this whole beach is now closed. It's empty. I can see two cops in the far distance patrolling the sand. But apart from that, pigeons, seagulls, fluttering flags.
Susanna Portella's coconut and caipirinha stall has gone. I call her to find out how she's coping. She's very worried, she says. Her stepdaughters tested positive. Susanna's holed up in a tiny apartment with her husband. Unpaid bills are piling up. And she really misses the beach life. I hope for her sake and many others, this virus is swiftly defeated so that Copacabana reopens soon. I'll go there more often after this, and I'll certainly be back on New Year's Eve, jumping up and down in the surf, making a wish that this never happens again. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And as the weeks of stay-at-home orders mount, the daycare industry, according to one expert, is close to the brink of collapse. Earlier this month, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Tina Smith introduced a $50 billion bailout of the industry. But Helen Blank, the former director of child care and early learning at the National Women's Law Center, says that still doesn't account for the growing educational divide between the rich and the poor. Helen Blank joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Happy to be here today with you.
You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about what some are calling this COVID slide, kind of like that summer slide where kids lose some of the academic achievement gains from the previous year. You say this is definitely something that we are going to see after all of this.
Yeah, I think it's clear, and it's especially clear for low-income children. I mean, we've always had a deep divide and, you know, our system is characterized by huge inequities, but the virus has exacerbated this divide and revealed how deep it is, because we are going to have a slide from all children because school is not being approached the way it always has been. But we have so many children who have basic lack of access to the internet when we're doing remote learning, and this is because of resources or geography. They don't have the devices. And their families, at first I thought, you know, their families are just too busy to support children's learning. And, you know, then I realized that we have families who are simply not there. Essential workers who go to work, maybe leaving 12-year-olds with younger children, or, you know, leaving school-age children home alone. So we hear higher income families talk about the fact that they can't do the math, right? It's so hard to help their children. But we have families who just aren't there. Yeah, and the divide that we have is just going to get bigger and bigger in terms of children losing learning.
You know, we're not hearing a lot about what this means for even younger children. As you mentioned, schools often provide before and after school care, but this is a huge strain for families with children not yet in school, but daycare essentially.
You know, our child care system is actually on the verge of collapse. We've always had a very patchwork system that is not supported with enough public funds. Most of it is private funding, unlike schools. And with so many families working from home and shouldering caregiving responsibilities and frontline workers struggling to find and afford child care, this crisis is really a wake-up call, because the childcare workforce is a critical family support and really an engine of our economy. And even before this, we had very few families eligible for help in paying for childcare. We had a workforce that was disproportionately women of color and immigrant families, and they were paid extraordinarily low wages. They struggled to meet the needs of their own families. So we have two issues.
What do you think is the possible future for childcare workers in this country? Meaning, what will it take to make these childcare facilities safe? You know, we're talking about social distancing being the norm well into possibly 2022.
I think we are going to have to pay enormous attention to childcare. It's always been a side issue. Somehow, you know, parents make do, and childcare providers have held it up. But given the stress it's under now, we're going to have to look at how we infuse a significant amount of new resources into the system so we can have smaller class sizes, enough teachers for fewer numbers of children. We're going to also have to support the childcare workers and the childcare system. So if parents aren't there, the childcare programs get paid regardless so they can stay open.
When we see this anticipated education gap happen, I just know we're going to hear what parents and teachers could have done differently. The educational disparity solutions are often so focused on the individual and not the collective or the system. What are some solutions you'd like to see implemented during this time?
There's no way around it. We needed government intervention before we saw the virus. There have been comprehensive bills introduced, one by Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, one by Senator Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, that would get our system on the right track. And we have to go back and look at those, because this isn't just the $50 billion that advocates estimate that we need to open up the system now and take care of the crisis. This really calls for creating the kind of government help we need to have a childcare system that's publicly funded like our school system. Because we already know parents are paying more than they can afford for childcare, and that still means that the providers are not paying what they need. And it doesn't and it hasn't worked without a strong role for government. And we have to think about how we care for children of low-wage, low-income families, because those children are the most stressed from what's going on now. So we have to look at what kind of economic and healthcare system we have, so all these children and their families don't fall through the cracks. And we have to have a high-quality childcare pre-K system that meets the needs of children and their families, that allows parents to work knowing their children are in safe, stable, high-quality places.
That's Helen Blank, former director for leadership and public policy at the National Women's Law Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
So what does this all mean for service providers who are still operating? Cynthia Davis joins us now. She's the president of the DC Family Child Care Association and owner of the King and Queens Child Care Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Cynthia, King and Queens Child Care Center is a home-based care center, and you typically have about 5 children in your care. Right now, you're down to 2. Tell us about these families and how you're managing safety measures.
Basically, what we're doing is I'm just open for essential workers, and the families that I'm serving now are essential workers, nurses, work in the healthcare industry. So what we're basically doing is keeping our 6 feet distance, our social distance. Some of the children, because they are really young, they don't like to keep the face mask on. But as they come in, we're taking temperatures as they enter the program. And once they enter the program, we're telling parents there is no such thing at this point of a common cold. So the children cannot have sneezing. They can't have runny noses, certain things like that, like a continuous cough, a dry cough. So we're looking for the signs and symptoms with the children. And we also we'll let the parents know that they can't bring their children if they are presenting any of those signs.
Yeah. So you're implementing these safety measures, you're supporting essential workers, but this is also a financial strain for you. We just spoke with Helen Blank. She's worried about the future of the system. How are you preparing, and are you worried?
Oh, yes, I'm really getting worried because some of the parents have decided that they're taking their children out. And because I do children that are part of the subsidy program and private children, and when you're losing so many of your private pay, it's really like starting to stress you out because now you're going into your savings. We applied for many grants. You know, some of them have not yielded yet. And the Paycheck Protection Program have already exhausted all its funds. So it's like, where do we really turn? If this continues to June, I'm going to have to start not paying my mortgage, trying to make other arrangements for bills and things like that. It's really starting to get straight. And a lot of private people, providers, home-based providers who are actually taking in private pay only, and the majority of our constituents and members are really over 50 years old. So this is not a profession that we're really young. And a lot of them are 60 plus. So, you know, they're on Social Security. This was like a supplemental income. They don't have a lot of children. We really get into a financial bind. It's really getting bad.
Yeah. You're hoping for relief before June, because after June, you're not sure what's going to happen.
Absolutely. If I don't do something like sooner, because remember, I'm still losing parents as the months go on. So even though I'm having two children now, one of the parents decided that she just had a new infant, that she is going to withdraw the other child because of the in and out of that one child. And then she don't want to create a situation where she's jeopardizing her newborn. And I totally understand that.
Yes. You have a master's in education, and you and other providers, as part of the work you do, have sent resources to parents. Bringing this to the focus of those most impacted, the children, what's at stake for them and their education if many of these childcare centers won't be able to bounce back?
Everyone is talking about social distance, but they're not talking about the peer-to-peer interactions that children have every day. It's really going to affect them because parents are going to be the primary teachers for several months. I know parents are having a hard time really like adapting their own lives. And now remember, children have friends. They used to come into school with their friends. They get to see their parents every day. They love their parents, but they want to get out and play. They want to interact with other children. This is really, we know that bonding is a major goal for children and a good thing for them to do throughout the years so that they can be social people later in life. But if we're not creating those interactions with children and be doing social distance, this can have an adverse effect for long term.
That's Cynthia Davis, the president of the DC Family Child Care Association and owner of the King and Queens Child Care Center, a home-based provider in Washington, D.C. Cynthia, thank you so much for your work, and my best to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
President Trump and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke on the phone today, and Johnson's office says the two leaders agreed there needs to be a coordinated international response to the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us now from the UK is NPR's Frank Langfitt. Frank, there's been some criticism of Prime Minister Johnson for his response to COVID-19. As we know, he had a serious case himself, ended up in the ICU. Do you think this phone call is supposed to show he's back on the job?
I think it's trying to give that the impression, at least, Jeremy, that he's engaged. You know, right now he's out at the Prime Minister's estate in Chequers, just outside of London. He's not doing any government business. We haven't seen him on video since after he just got out of the hospital. That was, I want to say that was more than a week ago. And as you said, Johnson was sick. He could have died, he said. And all along, there's been the sense the recovery is going to take a lot of time. And I think what he's trying to show is that he is some degree engaged and hopefully will be coming back relatively soon.
And is he facing new criticism now for how he's handled the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly over this weekend, we saw in the Sunday Times of London accusations that he missed five emergency meetings on the coronavirus and was on vacation as the coronavirus was spreading here. Of course, I think everybody knows the government was seen as pretty slow to react here. The government has pushed back, saying he wasn't expected at these meetings. He's also been criticized, and particularly the health department here, for the lack of PPE. There just hasn't been enough. Particularly, they're missing gowns. They need a lot of gowns. Apparently, there are 400,000 that they're trying trying to source out of Turkey now that they thought would be here over the weekend. They had to send an RAF, Royal Air Force cargo plane to Istanbul to try to pick it up. So, yes, a lot of criticism still ongoing for the government here.
And there are new numbers looking at the toll that coronavirus is taking in Britain. What does today's report on the death toll say?
Of course, it keeps going up. It's over 17,300. And the numbers are thought to be considerably higher because this isn't counting deaths in private homes or nursing homes. Nursing homes are saying they think thousands more people have died. Now, there is some good news here. There are signs that the deaths may have peaked earlier this month. And the healthcare system is holding up. There was a real fear that what happened in northern Italy would happen here. That's not the case. They still have 3,000 ICU beds. Patients are in decline right now. So that's a very good sign for the government and for the people here.
Is there the same pressure in the UK as there is in some parts of the United States right now to reopen the economy quickly? I'm thinking of places like Georgia and South Carolina, which are already unveiling their plans. What about in the UK?
No, I'd say there's a real difference. I think people here, Jeremy, were a little slow to respond, but they seem to be a lot more respectful about it. One of the things that we're seeing, I was just talking to a doctor today in London, and she said on her ward, she says social distancing is working. She's not getting new community cases. It tends to be more family members of people who've already been sick. And people are mostly following the rules, but there is tension in the cabinet. Certainly the economic side of the cabinet is very concerned because Britain's economy is expected to shrink by 35% this spring. Unemployment should go over 2 million. So there's pressure to reopen. On the other hand, you have people in the health decide part of this who are very careful. They don't want to open up too quickly and see a rebound.
Mm-hmm. NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thank you, Frank.
You're very welcome, Jeremy.
And now more than ever, so many of us rely on the U.S. Postal Service to deliver not only our mail, but essential packages like food and medicine. And yet the organization is facing some serious financial troubles, anticipating a loss of $2 billion a month during this pandemic. A bailout does not seem likely at the moment either. President Trump recently refused to sign the CARES Act if it funded the Postal Service. For more, we're joined by Philip Rubio, professor of history at North Carolina A&T University. And Philip is also a former postal worker. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The Postal Service feels very much like an essential service. It employs more than 600,000 people. And thinking about how we got to this present moment, which feels like financial ruin, really, you say this starts with an uprising from workers back in 1970.
Absolutely. It dates back to the United States Post Office, which is when that nationwide illegal wildcat strike took place because postal workers had just had it. They were tired of seeing such puny raises that were not giving them a living wage. Many of them were living on welfare with food stamps while they were working for the post office. And there was a battle between President Nixon, who wanted his postal corporation, and the postal unions, who wanted to have full collective bargaining rights within a government agency. What we wound up with was a compromise, essentially. The Postal Reorganization Act of 1970 led to the establishment of this hybrid that we have today called the U.S. Postal Service. So it's part government agency and part corporation, because postal workers are the only government employees who enjoy full collective bargaining rights. But on the other hand, Congress also directed the Postal Service to become self-supporting. They have not received any federal funds, in fact, since 1982.
You know, that's really interesting and astounding for many people who likely don't know the history, that the Postal Service has not received federal funding since 1982. That's a really long time. It really seems like the Postal Service has managed to stay afloat for the last few years, but the last 10 years it has faced really routine financial problems, really starting back in 2006. What happened in 2006?
Right. Well, so 2006, essentially, the George W. Bush administration balanced their budget on the backs of the U.S. Postal Service, which had overpaid by some tens of billions of dollars into the pension funds. And rather than pay the Postal Service back, what they did was write into law, which a new law called the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, that forced the Postal Service to have to pony up $5.5 billion a year for 10 years, paying it forward for retiree health benefits 75 years. In other words, retirees who hadn't even been born yet, much less taken the postal exam. So what happened starting... Well, 2 years later, we had the Great Recession, and the Postal Service has never required a bailout. But in 2009 is really when we can date the postal financial crisis, when they started to bleed red ink.
Because they did not receive a bailout in 2009.
Yes. What Congress did was refuse to repeal that law. So the Postal Service began having to do panic austerity measures that didn't help that much.
Now we see a reboot of all of what you're talking about, but why is there this contentious relationship for a service that seems to be such an essential service for just about everyone in the country?
That is a good question. It's got a lot of people scratching their heads. And what I would argue, what I have argued, is that there has been a longstanding conservative agenda that has regarded the Postal Service, and even before that, the Post Office, as a dinosaur from the past or socialistic or something that should be privatized, with its most lucrative services sold off to private carriers like UPS or to FedEx. And what happened with the postal financial crisis of 2009 is it provided that kind of, I guess you could say, self-fulfilling prophecy.
In your opinion, what's at stake, especially in an election year, if we can't count on the postal service system and the postal workers? The president has been very vocal about being opposed to voting by mail, for instance. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's at stake as we enter into continued pushes for federal funding for the U.S. Postal Service?
I think the Trump administration is playing a costly game of chicken with the post office. I really don't think they want to run it into the ground in an election year. After all, even though Trump doesn't see the value of voting by mail, which I think it would help protect our democracy, it could be secure. That's been proven. But besides that, who's going to deliver the stimulus checks? Who's going to deliver the millions of prescriptions that every day go out? The letters, the cards, the parcels, anything that you can put postage on. So, you know, we can count on the post office, but what we have to be afraid of is Congress not doing their job and President Trump apparently willing to take that chance. So what happens next? We don't know.
That's Philip Rubio, professor of history at North Carolina A&T State University and author of Undelivered: From the Great Postal Strike of 1970 to the Manufactured Crisis of the U.S. Postal Service. Philip, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The dairy industry is also having its share of challenges right now. It's hard to find milk in some stores, and at the same time, some farmers around the country have had to dump their milk. David Summerstein of North Country Public Radio explains.
Earlier this month, Lyle Wood of Clayton, New York, got the notice from his milk co-op, Dairy Farmers of America, dump 3 loads of milk a week.
Which meant Monday afternoon we're dumping, Wednesday afternoon we're dumping, and Friday afternoon we're dumping.
About 9,000 gallons of perfectly good milk from his 1,200 cows down the drain.
To watch it go down the drain is just very disheartening, I would say is the word, or just doesn't make you feel real good.
Across the nation, dairy farmers have been dumping milk for a couple weeks now because there's an oversupply. And yet, get this, there's this apparent total contradiction.
I am seeing store shelves empty day after day after day of dairy products. And yet we've got dairy farms being told to dump their milk.
Jay Madison is the agricultural coordinator for Jefferson County in northern New York State. He says it all started with the initial run on food at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic.
People went to the stores, they bought milk, they bought butter, they bought everything.
But milk, of course, is very perishable. The whole supply chain is built on delivering just enough milk to sell right away.
All of a sudden, this system that operated on basically on demand, you know, the milk was supplied just before it was needed. And it's screwed the whole system up.
Most dairy farms are far from where the big demand is, big cities. And some milk plants closed or slowed down to prevent COVID-19 from getting inside. So that's all slowing the system down. But it was when the other shoe dropped that things got really bad, Madison says. Governors ordered closed dairy farmers' biggest market by far, schools and restaurants.
You know, the 5-pound tubs of sour cream and cream cheese. And every time a burger joint puts 2 slices of cheese on a burger, that's over the country, over the United States. That's a lot of demand for cheese. All of a sudden, we saw that go almost completely away.
So you have more demand in the dairy aisle at the grocery store, but lots less demand from the prepared foods industry. Andrew Novakovich is professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University. He says the bottom line is bad for farmers.
The net-net of the parts of the dairy industry that are selling more against the parts of the dairy industry that are selling less is clearly pushing down on total sales opportunities.
And that's why the Dairy Farmers of America Milk Co-op is telling Lyle Wood in northern New York to dump 3 loads of milk a week. And that especially hurts, Wood says, because farmers thought 2020 would be a comeback year for dairy.
We've had 5 years of bad milk prices, and boy, this is the year we're finally going to knock it out of the park.
But Wood says milk prices could drop as low as $10 per hundredweight, far below the cost of production. Politicians in dairy country and farm groups are calling on the federal government to provide financial assistance and to buy dairy products for food programs. Wood says for now, he has no alternative but to shrug it off, keep working, and keep dumping milk.
Just keep looking forward and keep trying to put one foot in front of the other and working with your bank and working with different people and just trying to, like I said, keep moving forward.
For Here and Now, I'm David Summerstein.
Last month, after Ohio's Governor Mike DeWine ordered businesses, including restaurants, to close to the public, I spoke with Jessica Parkison, co-owner of a restaurant in Lakewood, Ohio called Salt. It had shut down and had to lay off its staff. Jessica feared she would never be able to reopen. This was before the CARES Act was passed by Congress. Well, we've got Jessica on the line now to see whether things have changed. Jessica, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, Jeremy. Thank you for having me back.
Well, and it's been a month since Salt closed to the public. How is it going at this point?
It's going okay. We opened, we're going into our third week of curbside. We do a total non-touch transaction with our customers that call in. Everything's paid over the phone. We have them pull up next to us with their trunks open, place their food into their trunks, and away they go. We were able to hire back almost our entire kitchen staff, all of our salary employees. 2 other servers came back to help out with car deliveries and whatnot.
And how do you make sure that your staff are being safe and are able to distance from each other while they're working?
We have been pretty much together since all of this has gone down. So if you want to call it quarantining amongst ourselves. I have a cousin that made us all masks that we wear, gloves, obviously, when we're preparing things. We had a local distillery, watershed distillery, dropped off 10 gallons of hand sanitizer for us that they had made, and we're using that as well.
And did you apply for small business loans, and were you able to get one before the program ran out of money the first time?
So the week that we closed, I believe it was that Thursday, was on with the disaster loan through SBA. I applied for it 3 separate times. All 3 separate times was kicked off the site, and the loan that I had been applying for was no longer there because they kept changing the verbiage of it. And so I'm assuming attorneys and whatnot had to repost everything. The PPP loan that had finally come out, I immediately got on the phone with my banks, they were able to help us assist it, and we signed off on our documentation yesterday. So I should have the PPP money, I'm hoping, within the next 10 days.
And are your employees able to make the amount of money that they were making before, or are they at least able to make enough to live on right now?
Yeah, so we kept our salary employees on, so they're making what they made before. And then our servers that came back, we're paying them a significant wage. And then plus any tips that come through, we disperse those.
Now, I have to say, I feel like I'm doing a good deed every time I order takeout from a local restaurant, because I want to support local businesses. And I wonder, how much are your customers making up for some of the difference? Are they ordering more than they otherwise would? Are they ordering less? What's going on?
People are ordering. We're selling out almost every single night, and they are taking fairly good care of our staff as well. So it's been wonderful.
So when do you think, based on what you're seeing there in Ohio, when do you think that you'll be able to reopen as a restaurant that people can come and sit down at? And do you think that they will do that when that possibility is there?
You know, we have a Governor DeWine who's been like on the forefront of the governors that have closed states down. He's talking about restaurants being in the first phase of reopening, which is May 1st. I have no idea what it's going to look like, and I don't know if we will open up during that first phase. There have been talks that, you know, you have to lose most of the capacity in your restaurant, only operating at 40%. If you have a bar in your restaurant, nobody will be allowed to sit at your bar, so you can't utilize that. I've heard talks about restaurants having to serve on disposable plates, flatware. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a huge cost for us, huge. Takeout is a huge cost for us. So monetarily, I'm just not sure if that would be in our cards to do. And maybe we would wait until phase two. But, you know, like I said, it's ever changing, and we're not making any concrete decisions until we hear what Governor DeWine has to say.
Last time we talked to you, you said that you weren't selling gift cards because you were worried people wouldn't be able to redeem them, because you were worried you wouldn't reopen at all. It sounds like you don't feel that way anymore, or do you?
You know, I go back and forth. If you would have asked me that question on Saturday, it probably would have been a different answer. Gift cards for us right now are great for the revenue that we would like to have right now, being that we're open for curbside. But in the future, I need that cash flow and not people paying their bills off of gift cards that they already paid for. So we're still not selling gift cards.
But do you think that you will reopen?
Yeah, I mean, we're fighting as hard as we can to reopen. That is our end goal. I mean, we're doing everything we can to try and maintain it and stay open and reopen.
That is Jessica Parkinson, who is co-owner of Salt, a restaurant in Lakewood, Ohio. Jessica, I'm glad to hear things are going a little bit better this time than when we last spoke to you. Continued good luck to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having us on again.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.